If you're a fan of big ideas, debate, and politics, check out our festival partner, geopolitical magazine, Foreign Policy. A forum for informed debate about global affairs, Foreign Policy keeps a finger on the pulse of world news and political happenings. Beyond articles that delve behind the headlines via traditional reporting, Foreign Policy has so many other products to offer, ensuring that no matter how you like to engage with eye-opening content, there is a method for you. Check out their free offerings, like Foreign Policy Live, their forum for live journalism, newsletters, and podcasts. And with a subscription, unlock in-depth features and quarterly magazines, including their recently dropped spring edition, All About India. Fans of IAI will love Foreign Policy for more of the mind-expanding, insightful content that they seek. To explore their content, take advantage of an exclusive discount for IAI fans. Subscribe now using promo code LIGHT24 to save 50% and unlock access to everything Foreign Policy has to offer.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. I'm Margarita, and I'm joined by the lovely Dan.
Lovely to be here.
Today we've got a rule to live by with Yale Professor of Law Daniel Markovits, celebrated feminist Carol Gilligan, and one of the world's leading ethicists, Peter Singer. In this debate, they discuss the place of the golden rule, or that famous principle of treating others as you wish to be treated, in philosophy and our lives.
If you like this debate, make sure to check out our lineup at this year's How the Light Gets In Festival, where we're going to be joined by Peter Singer again.
Indeed, and he's going to be debating Slavoj Žižek on universal morality. So head over to howthelightgetsin.org to find out more.
Great. Before we head over to Miriam Francois, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review on your platform of choice, and visit IITV for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Hello, lovely people. Thank you for being here. Treat others as you would wish to be treated is a central principle found in many cultures and all major religions. Known as the Golden Rule, it's widely seen as a cornerstone of morality. And yet, some argue the Golden Rule is wrong and damaging. It imposes our values, desires, and outlook on those with different experiences and goals. The extrovert may wish to be the center of attention, but it does not mean they should impose this on a shy neighbor. Furthermore, studies show that in clinical settings, golden rule thinking leads to inaccurate judgments with important consequences for medical policy. Should we abandon the golden rule as being too dangerously narrow? Should we seek to empathize with perspectives different from our own and treat others as they would wish to be treated? Or is this a shift that risks losing our moral compass and the golden rule as an essential universal law? We have a fantastic panel for you today. Daniel Markovits is a distinguished American legal scholar and the Guido Calabresi Professor of Law at Yale Law School. He's best known for his work on law and behavioral economics, contract law, distributive justice, and market regulation. Peter Singer, up here on the screen with us, is the most prominent figure in contemporary ethics. He's made groundbreaking contributions to animal welfare, bioethics, effective altruism, and practical ethics more broadly. And last but not least, Carol Gilligan is a celebrated feminist, ethicist, and psychologist. She is the mind behind An Ethics of Care, a revolutionary theory which moves beyond the traditional philosophical divides. Please give them a very warm welcome. Thank you. So we're going to kick off today. The way this works is each of our panelists will have 3 minutes to lay out their pitch in response to this first opening gambit, which is, should we abandon the golden rule that you should treat others as you would wish to be treated? Carol, I'm going to open with you.
Oh, okay.
3 minutes.
Yes, I'll tell you how I started to think about the golden rule. Because I was interviewing women, I was interested in how people think about real dilemmas of conflict and choice. And right after Roe v. Wade, the US Supreme Court decision in 1973 that gave women a legitimate voice and under certain constraints, a decisive voice in deciding whether to continue or abort a pregnancy, I interviewed pregnant women who were thinking about whether to continue or to abort their pregnancy. And what surprised me in listening to these women was their use of the word selfish to describe whatever it was that they wanted to do. If they wanted to have the baby, that was selfish. If they wanted to have the abortion, that was selfish. And what was responsible or good was to do what other people wanted them to do or thought that they should do. And to the point that I started to ask women, if it's good to be responsive to people and empathic with their needs and concerns, you're a person, why is it selfish to respond to yourself? And at that historical moment, this is the mid-1970s, woman after woman said, good question. Meaning that they were questioning a whole tradition in which the good woman was selfless, or as Virginia Woolf said, utterly unselfish, meaning having no needs, no voice, no perspective, no judgment basically of her own. So I started to think about the golden rule. And what I thought was that for women, at least, or some women at that time, that the golden rule was to do unto oneself what one did for others. In other words, to listen, to pay attention, to have respect for the perceptions and judgments. And it really was an inversion of the golden rule. And then it made me think about the assumption of the golden rule that do unto others as you would do unto yourself. It implied a person who had a very different view of themselves and was living under a very different set of moral traditions.
Thank you very much, Carol. Peter, over to you with your 3 minutes to respond to the opening pitch. Should we abandon the golden rule that you should treat others as you would wish to be treated?
No, we shouldn't abandon the golden rule. We should take it as a useful guide, but one that requires us to fill in a lot of information. And in particular, it requires us to treat others as we would wish to be treated if we were in their situation, not necessarily as we are ourselves. You gave the example of somebody, you know, if I'm an extrovert, I should not treat a shy person as I would wish to be treated given my extrovert nature. What I should do is think, if I were that shy person with that fear of being out in the public, making maybe speaking publicly or whatever it might be, then how would I want to be treated? So I think we have to understand the golden rule as taking on the desires and wishes and preferences and nature of others, and then it can be very useful. It's not a simple formula that you can use mechanically. You have to think about what the other person is like, what they want, be empathic with them, and then I think it's a very useful guide. And just to say something briefly about what Carol just said, yes, of course, if women are too self-abnegating, and they certainly have been in the past, maybe where when you did those interviews, I hope that they felt more empowered by feminism since. But if they are entirely self-abnegating, then they also need to consider their own interests. Really, I think the golden rule should be understood as impartial concern for others as they are, and that includes oneself.
Thank you very much, Peter. Daniel, over to you for 3 minutes. Should we abandon the golden rule that you should treat others as you would wish to be treated?
Thank you for letting me be here, and thank you all for being here yourselves. I want to begin with a relatively straightforward, banal story, which in its ordinariness, I think illustrates some of what's been said in more powerful and profound context, and then give a moral lesson from it. So a few years back, a friend had written what turned out to be a very controversial memoir. And she sent it to me and asked me to read it, and she bought me coffee, and she said, would you publish this if you were me? And I looked at her and I said, well, which one of us are we both? Are we both you or are we both me? Because if we're both me, we're not publishing this. But if we're both you, I think you should publish it because it will achieve your ends. Now, the point is that the answer to the question, how would you like it if somebody did that to you, depends on which one of us you are. And in ordinary cases, like with the low-stakes publication of this memoir, where it's really just a matter of preferences, or in the example with the extrovert and the introvert, where it's really just a matter of preferences, it's relatively easy to imagine ourselves in somebody else's shoes with their preferences and do what they would want. The problem becomes harder when the stakes go up, and when we're not just talking about preferences, but we're talking about moral principles. Let me give a simple example and then something even more stressful. So the simple example is I teach, among other things, and when I teach my classes, I teach views that I regard as false and malign with exactly the same enthusiasm that I use to teach views that I regard as true and honorable. The reason is the purpose of teaching is not to persuade people of my own morality. Rather, I'm a custodian of the situation. But that's hard when the views that I think of as malign are really harmful in the world. And as the moral stakes go up, and as putting ourselves in the other person's position requires embracing not just preferences, but ideals and beliefs that we regard as genuinely wrongful, it becomes much harder to apply the golden rule in this generous way and not use it to impose our own views, which after all we think are right. Understood in the generous way, the golden rule requires us to do less good by our own rights than we are able to, because we're custodians of a situation that has to respect perspectives that we regard as deeply damaging. And I think the open question for our politics right now is whether, in the role of democratic citizen, we can or should view ourselves as custodians of the situation and sometimes defer to views that we regard as malign on account of the sophisticated version of the golden rule, or whether we should do the most good we can as seen by our own lights, even if we run roughshod over other people's wrongful beliefs. And I think that's a very hard question and what I think this panel is largely going to end up being about.
This is such an interesting topic to explore with some Americans on the top on the panel as well, in the context of the rise of a sort of political Christian evangelical perspective within your own politics. So I hope we'll get to touch on that a little bit. So I want to move on to the philosophical heart of this question. So the Golden Rule is an age-old universal law found across all religions, pretty much. But if you ask people the question, what is the very foundation of objective moral law? I mean, the question is for the panel, let's kick off with this one. Is it possible in the first instance to find overall universal principles of morality?
Yes, I think it is possible to find rather broad, abstract universal principles of morality. And I think a generalized version of the Golden Rule is such a principle. So it's obviously not enough for a basic moral principle to say put yourself in the position of someone else, because there are many situations in which many people are involved, and not only human beings but also non-human animals are involved. So I think the correct principle, really, that I think is more or less universal, is we should put ourselves in the position of all of those affected by our actions, try to take on what the impact of our choice, if we're facing an ethical choice, is for everyone affected, weighing their interests impartially, considering what those interests are. So equal consideration for similar interests would be a way that I would put this. And I do think that this is a universal principle. I think you find it in many traditions. You certainly find the Golden Rule in many traditions. Go back to Confucius. You find it in the Jewish thinker around the first century, Hillel. You find it in, Jesus says it in one of the Gospels. It's in the Mahabharata, the Hindu text. And then when you get to more philosophical understandings of it, you do get something like, judge your action from an impartial perspective, or would an impartial spectator approve of your actions? And so I see that as a principle that thinkers can come to if they think carefully and impartially about the basis of morality.
And am I right in thinking that while most people might root that principle in things like religious laws or the fabrics of the universe, where do you find the basis for this principle?
Yes, I don't root it in any religious teachings because I'm not religious. I find it in, if you like, philosophical reflection on the basis of morality. Some thinkers, like the great 19th century utilitarian Henry Sidgwick, thinks that it's a self-evident axiom, that we can derive it as something that people who are thinking clearly and calmly will come to. And I think that there is something in that view. I think we can regard some of these basic axioms as self-evident, not in the sense that they strike everybody intuitively as the right thing to do, because our intuitions might be guided by our evolutionary past or by culture and might be misleading. But if we try to put aside those particular attitudes and prejudices and just think about the situation in an impartial way, I think we reach this point that everyone's interests count and similar interests count equally.
Daniel, I'd love to bring you in on that. Can we just take an impartial perspective and look at everyone's opinions equally?
So I think there may be some disagreement here. I think impartiality is more layered, more complex, and more difficult, Peter, than I think the way you've characterized it. There's a question of impartiality about people's interests. Should everyone's well-being count equally? And I'm inclined to say the answer to that is yes, and that's a form of impartiality. But people also are valuers. They don't just have interests. They evaluate what's in people's interests. And should everybody's views about what counts as people's interests be taken equally? Is that a kind of impartiality? Well, that's very hard to do. And it has very concrete consequences. It becomes really difficult to know how to behave very quickly. One example, when I was growing up, one of my best friends was an evangelical Christian. I am an atheist Jew. Now, how was she supposed to treat me impartially? On the one hand, if she cared for my interests impartially, she should devote a great deal of energy to converting me out of my current set of beliefs towards hers, because from her sincere perspective, my eternal soul was at stake. On the other hand, if she behaved towards me in that way, I might have a legitimate gripe that she's disrespecting me in a certain way as a valuer, because she is treating my views as false and therefore not worthy of the same respect that her true views have. On the other hand, it's really, really hard to treat views that you think are false with the same respect that you accord views that you think are true. So now what does one do? Well, that's very difficult. And I think that's why something like impartiality doesn't quickly get us to a solution to this problem. My own view, and maybe we'll get into this eventually, is that what we need is a politics, an intersubjective set of practices and processes that enable us to have this fight in a way that's not destructive, but productive. And what that politics looks like maybe is something that's worth talking about at some point.
So what would your alternative to impartial universal laws be? I mean, I understand a politic is obviously a way to get there.
So I'm inclined to think that the trick, and this is maybe the way in which a lawyer thinks, I'm inclined to think the trick is to recede to process, to say that we should try to avoid making substantive judgments about universals and instead have principles that say everybody gets a say, everybody's voice should be listened to, everybody deserves an answer. And then we should construct a set of multi-layered institutions that make sure that you always have someone who will listen to you, whether that's a council in your local community or an international court that protects your human rights in a certain way or a national level democratic process. If we have enough layers that prevent any one perspective from commandeering what we all do, then it gives more freedom for people to pursue their own authentic views and to try to do the most good for the most people as they see it, in the knowledge that people who see it differently will remain free to push back. It's an unsettling and unsatisfying position to be in, but I think it's the best that we can do given how fundamentally we disagree.
So the limits to that tolerance would be those who don't believe in a system that would allow for the space for those multiplicity of perspectives to exist in.
Yeah, so look, there's a doctrine that, for example, the Germans have invented called militant democracy, which insists on democracy to the point that those who reject democracy are excluded from politics. Now, that's a costly thing to do because you're trampling on people, some of whom are sincerely promoting their most heartfelt beliefs. My own view, and this you might say is a cynical view, is that in circumstances in which the intolerant might win, militant democracy is the right answer. In circumstances in which the intolerant are unlikely to win, one should give even the intolerant access to politics. And it's a matter of judgment and political leadership to know which circumstances we're in and how to speak about them in a way that's not quite as nakedly calculating as what I just did.
Visa, I definitely want to bring you back in a second to respond, but Carol, I'd love to hear your input on what we've been saying.
Well, I'm sitting here listening to, I guess you're a philosopher too, Daniel, or?
Sort of,
okay. Well, I'm a psychologist, so I have this sense of who decides on what's impartial, and I mean, I would bring politics in the sense of whose version, and then you put yourself in another person's position. how much does that mean you have to know about the other person? I mean, it's like this is something that seems to me to be going on in people's heads. I think the reality, and I think we're so facing this now, is we live in a world where we are interdependent. In other words, we have to live with one another because that's just the reality of the world. So I think that the, if you want to say what's kind of, what's the bottom line, what's the universal here, is we have to figure out how to live in relationship with people who can be very different from us. And I think if there's a principle, or at least a kind of approach, it's notice what happens when you replace judgment with curiosity. Because I think that's where you have to begin to be interested in and curious about people who may in the beginning seem to you to have a position which is inconceivable or just feels like intolerable or something. And if you just sit and judge it, it's not, that's, there's no relationship there. And it's just a question ultimately of, you know, it's the use of force, who has more power. So democracy, the idea of democracy is that everyone has a voice. So what we talk about, there's a moral philosopher at the Sorbonne, Sandra Logier, who talks about a paradigm of attention, of learning what it means to pay attention, to listen, to engage, to respond, not in the easy situations, but in these very difficult situations. That, to me, is the bottom line here.
And so just, Carol, to pick up on that, so is there an impartial set of moral laws that we can refer to in order to navigate that?
Well, I mean, again, I would shift the framework. I don't think, like, who's the impartial person? I mean, you know, who decides?
Daniel, he's got a view on that.
Yeah. Is it Daniel or Peter?
Or Peter. Yeah.
And who decides who's impartial and who makes the universal law? I mean, I think, you know, honestly, if you don't have an idea of a God who's doing this, I don't know how you decide whose point of view is considered impartial. So that's where I think you shift the paradigm, you shift the framework, and you talk about what does it mean for human beings to live in relationship? How are we going to survive on this planet without destroying it? Now that we have nuclear weapons, how are we going to survive without destroying one another? So we're going to have to figure out. I think it takes us from philosophy, I would say, into something much more psychological. And what happens? What are the costs when you don't listen to people, when you don't pay attention? Well, we know something about that.
So Daniel, I want to bring you in, but I did promise Peter a right to reply to that. So please, Peter, I want to bring you in.
Yeah, I think both with what Daniel said and with what Carol has said, it's really important to distinguish between trying to make up our own minds as to what we think is the right thing to do, the ethical choice, if you like, and the politics of the process of how we are going to reach decisions in a large society, decisions for the society as a whole. And these are different questions. I mean, they're certainly related, but there may be moral choices that I make that are not political choices. They're choices that I decide, what am I going to do with my money? Am I going to assist people in extreme poverty by finding an effective charity that is helping them and donate to that? What am I going to eat? Am I going to eat products from factory farms and be complicit in the suffering inflicted on animals there? Or am I going to avoid those products? They're not political choices. They're, although, you know, certainly my views might lead me to politics in terms of advocating that government policy help do more to help people in poverty and prohibit factory farming. But those are then separate choices. And so I think the question about that Carol is asking, you know, who is going to be impartial when we're making the ethical choices? That's up to us. We try to think as impartially as we possibly can. We try to get the relevant facts right, and we reach our decisions on that basis. When we are engaging in politics, yes, then we have to do so in good faith. We can certainly argue for our views, but we recognize that other people will have different views. And in a democracy, we have a method of deciding who is going to prevail in those differences. Although, unfortunately, in the United States, we just seem to reach stalemates and blockades, and maybe the government is not even going to be funded, Richard, but this is the chaotic politics here that I do not recommend as a desirable way of solving political problems. But in general, you know, in a democracy that functions well, we will respect each other's views and allow people the opportunity to speak freely. And I thought what Daniel said about militant democracy, when we should exclude people who don't accept the democratic process and when we should not, was actually very wise. I'm inclined to favor that view. But if we have a democracy that functions well, then that process would decide. But of course, we are still free to argue for our view and try to persuade more people to join us. That's the process we're engaged in.
Thank you, Peter. Dan?
I wanted maybe to frame something a little bit as a question, partly, Carol, for you, partly, Peter, for you. I think, Carol, you and I are agreeing in a certain way. And I think, Peter, we actually have a disagreement. I wonder whether that's right. With Carol, with you, I think what you're saying is a psychologist's description of what I am describing as a lawyer, which is to say a relationship has the feature that no person's perspective on it is the whole relationship.
Right.
Instead, it's intersubjective, and it can't be reduced to either person's participation in it. Well, and I'm inclined to say a legal process or a political process is the same. You know, in a trial, you have the prosecution, the defense, and the judge. Who has the right perspective on it? None of them. It's a process that balances them out. And that one way to think about this is we need to construct relationships and processes that we can each participate in from our own perspective, while also understanding that our perspective on them isn't the whole of them. And that's partly this curiosity point. Now, I wonder whether, now I think if one thinks of that way, there is though some disagreement with something that you said, Peter. You said, ethically, morally, I judge for me. And I'm a little more skeptical of that, even in the simplest case of ethics, which is to say, it's always the case that when I think that there's a right thing to do and a wrong thing to do, I will be embedded in a context, a situation, and other people. And it may not be political in the sense that the personal is political. It may be, but it may not be. But it's always the case that there are other perspectives on what I'm doing too. And I'm inclined to the view that I should always dampen my own views on account of these other perspectives and never simply do what I think is best. Now, of course, that is also an easy excuse for moral cop-outs. And I don't know how to think about that. And I wonder, Peter, whether we disagree on that. And Carol, so that was just sort of a question for, I don't know if I'm allowed to pose questions to other speakers, but.
You can do as you wish,
Daniel. I just want to bring in again, though, the point I raised at the beginning is this assumption that, you know, I should consider other people's opinions as well as my own. And the struggle, and Peter, I think you're very optimistic because I still hear the word selfish from women students who will dismiss their own question as selfish and think that other people's questions are good questions, that it's still a struggle for many women to actually give one's own voice and opinions and feelings as much credibility as other people's. And so I think, I just don't want that to get lost here, because it's like, who, you could almost say, who has lived in such a way to believe that if they say something, someone will listen to them? And there are many, many people who feel no one will listen to them, no one has ever listened to them, no one should listen to them, because it would be selfish to tell you what I really think. And I mean, there's a human voice that goes undercover, and that's the voice of what I really think. And I always, there was a woman early on when I was asking people hypothetical moral dilemmas. I was going to say like the kind you guys use all the time. And this woman, she looked at me, she was my age, and maybe it was my hair or something like that. But she said to me, would you like to know what I think, or would you like to know what I really think? And if you think about it, what she was telling me is that she had learned to think about morality in a way that differed from how she really thought, that she was aware of the difference, and she could tell me what she thought about morality, or she could tell me what she really thought about morality. So I think in this conversation, we also have to think about, what does it take to create the circumstances in which people actually have access to and will say what they really think and feel, because you can't have a functioning democracy otherwise.
So that takes us very nicely to the second theme of this debate that I would like to engage with, which is some of the more practical applications of this discussion, right? So we've talked about the legitimacy of universal laws, but I want to move on to what is a practical application of the Golden Rule look like? And the Golden Rule tells us to treat others as you wish to be treated, but obviously we know that that can't possibly be the guiding rule of our society, because as a society, we have accepted that, you know, people that don't look like us are allowed to drown in the Mediterranean when they're fleeing their countries. We've accepted it, right? Because otherwise it wouldn't happen. We could make different choices, but we haven't. We've accepted homelessness. We've accepted child poverty. All of these things that I'm sure in principle, lots of people here would say, no, it's a golden rule we all believe in, but we clearly don't in practice. So what might people wish to do that might be radically different, and how are we, you know, are we right to impose our own morality on others, or should we empathize simply with the different perspective of others? Should we simply say to someone who says, let them drown, I really empathize with your position? Peter.
Thank you. So yes, this does go back to something that Daniel was saying that he and I disagreed about, and that is, you know, whether, in what way we respect other people's values when we disagree. So what I think we should take into account is the effect that decisions we make will have on other people. So if, because they have certain values, they're going to be deeply offended and troubled by it, then I would certainly take that into account. It doesn't mean that I share those values, and I might still, if I can do it without causing offense, try to persuade them that those values are mistaken. But I'm certainly not saying that we should just ride roughshod over everyone else's values, irrespective of how that is going to affect them. Now, in terms of the practical applications, I certainly do think that we should apply the idea of, you know, how would I like it if I were in that situation, much more widely. And we should certainly apply it, as I was saying before, to people living in extreme poverty in low-income countries. I think it's shocking that we do so little. And when I say we, I mean people who are quite affluent, who spend money all the time on things that they don't really need, status kind of goods that are expensive, brands and so on. And I think that we should be sharing much more of that to try to help people in extreme poverty and ultimately to eliminate widespread extreme poverty, which after all was one of the sustainable development goals for 2030, though it doesn't really look like we're going to get there. So I think we should do much more of that. Some of the other situations that you described are obviously not so easy to solve. So I think we also have to be aware that, for example, child poverty is quite difficult to eradicate. We should certainly do more of it. We should do a lot more, but there are several priorities that governments have in terms of their spending, whether we should spend more on that, whether we should be more focused on climate change and trying to phase out our fossil fuel emissions and reduce the amount of meat we're consuming, because otherwise there'll be disastrous consequences for decades or centuries to come. Those are complicated issues, and we do need to respect people who might differ on their priorities.
But Peter, how do we get people to abide concretely with these moral principles that you are referring to without some kind of abiding pressure from above? And I'm going to say, for example, as a person of faith, the idea that God is, you know, accounting you, you know, you better hold yourself accountable for those principles, because otherwise God will. Which still means that we mess up all the time, but at least we're aware that there's something you should be holding yourself to account to. If you take God out of that accountability equation, where are you finding the rope that holds people to those axioms? It doesn't make it just, you know, well, today I'm feeling like a good person, but tomorrow I'm feeling like a bad person.
Yeah, but if you look at the sex abuse scandals in churches of various kinds,
yes,
it doesn't seem that belief in God necessarily keeps them from doing things that
I need you on that one.
Right. So I think what the pressure, if you like, and I don't know the pressure is the right term, the persuasive force is to try to get people to see that we're really fortunate that we could have been born in a low-income country. And not being wealthy, and I'm Warren Buffett, one of the world's richest men, said that if he'd been born in a village in Peru, the skills that he had in assessing good investments would not have been much use, and he could well have grown up and ended his entire life quite poor. So, you know, that kind of thinking maybe we can put to people, and we can hope to persuade them to think more about others. But there's no guarantee that we will. I agree. There's no surefire way of persuading everybody to think in the best possible ethical manner.
Oh, can I bring you in? Can we persuade people to converge on some kind of, you know, shared moral laws? Is there a way of doing that? Do we all not really, in theory, agree on not stealing, not raping, not killing?
First of all, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, who is we?
Indeed.
I mean, because if you say, do we all agree about not killing and raping? Obviously, there are people who kill and rape, so they don't agree on that. But, you know, again, I'm the psychologist here, and the overwhelming evidence now, and it's a real shift, and it's happened in the last basically 40 years, is that as human beings, I mean, when we come into this world, and this is across gender, I mean, the whole spectrum, we are basically responsive relational beings. I mean, we are born with mirror neurons with the capacity to register the feelings of other people. We desire to live not alone, but in relationship. I mean, if you actually think, no one survives unless somebody takes care of them. And so we have the ability to engage with others. You can watch this 5-minute still-faced experiment and see how at 1 year of age, how closely human babies track relationships. I mean, who's in touch and who isn't in touch and so forth. So that's where we start. And if you want to create a world where some people drown and nobody cares, and some people are poor and other people are very happy to go about their lives, you have to destroy these relational capacities. And so you have to look at what have we done that allows people to be indifferent to what's happening to themselves or to other people, and what allows us to be careless, for example, with the planet or with creatures or so forth. I mean, there's a very different question to ask here. I mean, as opposed to is there a God, and da-da-da, is kind of what has happened to human beings? And what do we need to do to develop and educate these basic human relational capacities that allow us to live in connection with ourselves and with one another? Because I think otherwise there's no way we're going to survive.
Thank you, Carol. Daniel, I'd love to bring you in on this concrete application.
Yeah, 2 points. First is on the question of relational capacities. It's incredibly important to foster those, but I think they're also complicated and can drive destruction as well as salvation. So bigotry involves an in-group as well as an out-group. And the in-group is built out of the relational capacities of the in-group members. And so we need to understand collectively how to construct relationships among people so that they resist in-group, out-group dynamics. That's a very complicated process. That's the first point. And the second point is there's also a real tension between whether the right way to end this kind of obvious malign and unjust suffering is to emphasize caring for disadvantaged and disempowered people because their interests are important, or to emphasize empowering those people. And those are quite different programs. The caring program is one which imagines that we, whoever we are, those with power or right-thinking people, come to see the moral truth of the matter and then take the steps required to prevent the evil from happening. Whereas the empowering program imagines what needs to be done or happen so that those on the receiving end of the evil are able to rise up and not take it anymore and make whatever claims they wish to make, which are not up to the rest of society to choose. And that's a very different kind of program and much more challenging. And it seems to me, at least watching the world right now, it's an open question in the short run, which program will be more effective at reducing the obvious evil in the world. Although I think in the long run, the answer has to be the empowering program, not the caring program.
I think that's a false dichotomy, because I think if you really care about people, you empower them.
So the reason why I'm reluctant to accept that is I know people who care about me deeply, but wish to control me so that I will do well by their lights.
As women, we're fairly experienced with that concept of
I'm worried about that.
Carol, Daniel's worried about that. I think as I think he should be. We don't want to forget you, Peter. Is there anything you wanted to come back before we move on to the third theme of our discussion today?
Well, I am inclined to agree with some of the things that Daniel just said then. I think you do have to think of, you know, Carol asked, well, what's happened to human beings? That seems to imply that somehow we've got worse. I don't think we have. If you look at the history of human beings, there has been, yes, good in-group relationships, but the relationships between groups have constantly turned to violence. It's hard to find cultures that have not engaged in conflicts with others in their group. And you can even go back to pre-human relatives like chimpanzees, where groups have some conflicts, as Jane Goodall observed. I think what's changed is that we have this new technology and we're much more powerful. And now we have the ability to destroy the world, both through nuclear weapons and more subtly through the release of greenhouse gases. And so, you know, understandably, we need to be more careful about what we're doing. And unfortunately, the way we were in the past doesn't really work very well anymore, because we don't have these inhibitions. We never evolved inhibitions about releasing a colorless, odorless gas into the atmosphere, which is something that now we do need to stop doing.
So to kick morality into gear, we need a mortal threat of some kind.
And we need to apply our reasoning and thought, and not just our instinctive reactions, to work out what we can do about it.
Thank you, Peter. Well, let's move on to our third and final theme for today, which is, would a shift away from the golden rule risk us losing our moral compass? Daniel, I suspect you don't think that would be the case.
Risk is a capacious word. Hannah Arendt once said, it's true that you can't make an omelet without breaking any eggs, but it's also true that you can break a great many eggs without making an omelet. And, you know, I have a series of complaints of a political, process-based, psychological, sociological, and philosophical nature about the golden rule. On the other hand, the basic instinct that everyone's life is equally important, that we should put ourselves in other people's shoes and try the best we can not to treat them in ways that we would regard as harmful and humiliating, and that we should do that for everybody, it seems like a not bad place to begin a certain kind of individual and collective moral life. And to jettison that too quickly seems extremely dangerous. So I'm inclined to say, and this is not a crisp or courageous position, to reform rather than replace the golden rule, and to build on top of it the sense that we should care not just for other people's interests, but also for their perspectives, and that that's an important thing that we need to learn how to do, and it's very difficult.
And in terms of power and power dynamics in the society, who is the we that can change that, and what are the mechanisms to ensure that in the name of good intentions, as we've seen throughout history, right? Terrible, terrible things can happen.
And look, this is hard to do, not just at the grand scale, but at the small scale. So Carol, I'm sure that you've had this experience too. Peter, probably you have also. I would say over the past 30 years, 50 graduate students have been in my office and have said, I would like to be a professor, but I don't think I have anything valuable to say. 100% of those 50 are women. I have never had a man come into my office and say, I would like to be a professor, but I don't have anything valuable to say. So
shocking.
What does one do in response to that? Well, what that suggests is that your question has two different answers.
Yeah.
Right? If you're in a group who is inclined by the structures you find yourself in to undervalue your own perspective, well, then you have to learn to value your own perspective more highly. Right. And if you're in a group that is inclined to overvalue your own perspective, you have to learn to value your own perspective a little less highly. And that matters in all sorts of little ways. You know, when you're in a seminar, all things equal, my principle is probably if you're a woman, speak up a little sooner than you would be inclined to. If you're a man, speak up a little later than you would be inclined to. And that's not an oppressive rule. It's just sensible practice in the shadow of the kind of question you're asking. And how to scale that up to a civilization is a very hard question. Mm. But even how to do it in your own life is not an easy question.
Peter, can I bring you in at this point? Do you think it's possible to replace, I won't say possible or desirable, to replace the golden rule with something else?
I think what we need to do is to go from the golden rule to a broader principle, possibly in some sense a more abstract principle, but to generalize so that we are not just thinking of it in terms of putting ourselves in the position of one other, and not even a large number of other humans alone, but also putting ourselves firstly in the position of distant strangers in other countries, then in the position of non-human animals as well. They have interests and they can't. And also in the position of future generations of people who are yet to be born. So, you know, that's harder to do in terms of actually knowing somebody and forming a relationship with them, especially those who are not yet born. But our actions today do have major implications for those who are not yet born. So I think that's the basically moving out from the golden rule to the principle of equal consideration of the interests of all those affected by our action, including, as I say, those who are not members of our species and those who do not yet exist.
Thanks, Peter. Caroline, what do we lose or what don't we lose of our moral system if we do abandon this golden rule?
You know, I think if we think about the golden rule as act as though you live in relationship with all other people, including yourself, I really think it's so interesting to me that that part keeps getting lost about how easily the self gets excluded. And I appreciate your illustrations of the, you know, if a woman comes into my office and says, I'd like to be a professor, but I have nothing to say, I would say, I don't believe you. I mean, I'm sure she has something to say. So that's like only the beginning, and you have to. So I think if the golden rule is a rule about how to live in relationship, then that's a reasonable rule, because I think so many of our problems come from really basically not being in relationship, whether it's with other people in the world or the future or whatever, and also with ourselves. So that's sort of where I stand on this.
Is there a golden rule moment here? Anyway, thank you very much to all of our panelists, Peter, Carol, and Daniel. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Philosophy for Our Times. We now have an email, and it's been great to hear from all of you, so make sure you get in contact at podcast@ii.tv with any questions for either the editorial team or our speakers, and we'll do our best to answer them in next week's episode. Thanks for listening.